Thanks, Brett, and welcome everyone. Today's panel, as Brett said, is Managing Risk in Volatile. The format for today is we plan to have a 40-minute session, of which 30 minutes will be a panel discussion, followed by a 10-minute Q&A. So if you haven't already, I'd encourage you to download the ISDA Conferences app and submit your questions, and if time permits, we'll try and get to it later on today. I'd like to start by introducing our panel. Firstly, we have Jo Dawson, the Group Treasurer for Westpac. She's responsible for Treasury operations, including balance sheet management, group liquidity, group global wholesale funding, capital management, and execution on balance sheet management. Chris Kent, the Assistant Governor of Financial Markets at the RBA, a role he's held since 2016. He's responsible for the oversight of the bank's operations in both domestic and global financial markets, including management of Australia's foreign reserves. He's also a representative on the BIS Markets Committee and BIS Committee on Global Financial Stability. And finally, Stuart Simmons, who's the head of multi-asset solutions at QIC, where his focus is on design and implementation of derivative-based investment solutions for asset owners. He's a member of the Australian FX Committee and also Australia's private sector representative to the Global Foreign Exchange Committee from 2019 to this year, 2023. So to set the scene, we know in recent years, global markets have experienced a series of pretty significant shocks, which have resulted in significant asset price volatility and subsequent stress in global liquidity. We're now in a situation of high sticky inflation, slowing global growth, and heightened geopolitical risk. So the outlook on how you manage risk in such a situation is highly uncertain for both financial institutions, asset owners and managers, as well as policy makers. Luckily, today we have three of those people to represent us and talk us through how we navigate those periods. I'll start with you, Joe, if I can. Given the multiple roles that you perform at Westpac, what's your thought process on how you manage that fine balance between the investment of the liquidity of the balance sheet but also maintaining adequate liquidity on how you support your clients and their growth ambitions, but against a backdrop of also protecting against potential market shocks?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting one. Thanks, Nick, for the question. I think for us, it's always about how do we maintain a really strong and robust balance sheet? And that's always our starting point for anything we consider in terms of how we think about the broader balance sheet itself. Yeah, from my perspective, we sort of think about what are the what's the market environment that we're in, what are the things that could that we could be facing, and think about setting our liquidity, setting our whether that be from a liquid asset perspective or where we're running our liquidity from a regulatory ratio or also our internal stress test, at an appropriate level for the market conditions that we're in. So we always consider that. We, as part of that, we sort of think about forecasting our balance sheet. We think about our customers and our customers' needs and what they might look like over the over the period ahead. And obviously, that's an important input in terms of how we think through the liquidity needs of the organisation. But obviously, in more volatile markets, we'll think about how to ensure that we've got that strength and maintain that strength of balance sheet.
Perfect. Stuart, I might jump over to you. You've got going to have a slightly different lens on your investment philosophy. And QIC's stated purpose is to deliver an optimum investment outcome with and for our clients. So as we've seen over the last couple of years, there's been a pretty significant change in the way people are looking at asset classes, whether that's investment into private markets to try and take out some of that volatility. But you then have to also weigh that against potentially staying in public markets and staying in more liquid markets where you have access to that liquidity. Can you talk us through how your lens and your approach works on that investment philosophy?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. It's pretty well known now that investors, and particularly super funds, are going more into those private markets, which helps to smooth out the market risk. But you do take on some other risks when you do that, and in particular, you've got to consider liquidity risk. And Australian investors have had a pretty good track record there of managing liquidity risk. If you look back to the COVID shock, that was a pretty extreme stress test for super funds. And there were stresses there, but they ended up coming through. You consider the triple whammy Firstly, you had the FX hedging losses. Secondly, you had really heightened member switching out of diversified and growth assets into cash. And thirdly, you had the government's early release scheme, which was unforeseen. And super funds managed to navigate through that, but really recent events, and you think about Silicon Valley Bank, or you think about the UK pension crisis in September last year, and it really goes to show how quickly things change and how these events seem to have accelerated. And it's probably a good time for super funds to, I mean, they can't rest easy. They've got to reflect on that and really look at how they're going to adapt to this environment where you do have these changes occurring so much faster than they have in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris, we might sort of jump into you, because I guess you're looking holistically across sort of the market and some of the risks and how the, I guess, everyone manages their risk. The RBA stepped in extremely quickly during COVID and provided not only lower rates but significant liquidity facilities to manage that stress that may occur, as Stuart mentioned. How is the RBA thinking about this going forward to deal with potential future financial market shocks? Given, you know, we've seen with the advent of COVID came out of nowhere, you really have to sort of protect against the unforeseen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're pretty well placed to deal with financial shocks that might come along to the system. I mean, the Australian financial system is in very good shape. We, as a central bank, have all the tools that we need and we can use them flexibly. And I think the other thing that we saw during COVID and in other episodes is we cooperate very closely with the key agencies, particularly APRA, ASIC, Treasury. As Joe suggested, the banks are in a very strong position in terms of their capital and liquidity, thanks to their efforts, but also overseen by APRA. And the recent turmoil in the US and European banks sort of showed that they are a world-leading regulator. There's a lot of liquidity in the system still as a consequence of our policies, our balance sheet policies, and that's going to be there for some time. And we can provide liquidity as needed, you know, through our open market operations. They're full allotment at the moment, so banks can get within reason what they need. They can pledge a wide range of collateral, and we can reach out, if needed, to about 150 counterparties, right? So money can go where it's needed, if it's needed. But so I think for all those reasons, we're pretty well placed, a strong financial market, and to deal with a shock if and when that occurs.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think we know that the Australian banks are actually perhaps the best capitalised in the world at this point in time. So we are in a very, very strong position compared to perhaps some of our global peers. Joe, jumping back to you and talking about sort of that capitalisation of sort of the banks, going forward, we're probably going to see continued reduction in global liquidity, even though, as Chris said, there is surplus and the market is very flush with liquidity, but that liquidity will be withdrawn slowly but surely. Can you talk us through your thought process when we look at global markets and the funding opportunities in terms of moving away from some of those liquidity facilities into global capital markets against a backdrop of the Australian yield curve is relatively flat, global yield curves quite heavily inverted, but then again, you have to also weigh up against sort of duration risks and how you're looking at that from a funding perspective.
Yeah, sure. So I think that you're absolutely right in terms of how the Australian banks are regarded relative to peers in global markets, and that certainly sets us at a good first foot when we go into markets more broadly. I think just speaking about liquidity and you know, obviously the runoff of the CLF over the course of 2022 and now with the maturity of the term funding facility, for us it's much more about getting back to normal, getting back to our normal activities of going back to wholesale funding markets. And we've been doing that for a little while now over the course of the last sort of year or so, getting back to what we would ordinarily do in accessing, you know, various markets, whether they be onshore or offshore markets, for the range of securities that we issue, whether that be senior covered bonds in the, you know, T2 space or AT1. So for us, it's very much about getting back to that normal level of activity you know, we certainly consider the rundown of liquidity in terms of those forecasts that I talked about before and how we might need to, fund ourselves over time. But, from our perspective, issuing in the term space has been, much more back to what we would ordinarily have done pre-COVID. In terms of how we look at markets, for us, we don't take duration through our term funding. Or what we look at is very much a relativity of all funding sources available to us back to a floating rate, 3-month quarterly swap in the Aussie market. So, and for us, that's very much about how we think about all our assets and liabilities across our sheet is back to that sort of neutral rate of quarterly BBSW. So, much more about how do we actually, we think about funding more from a liquidity and overall perspective than actually from a duration perspective for the balance sheet.
Perfect. Actually, Chris, we might follow on from there. As Joe mentioned, sort of the demise of the CLF and the roll-off of the TFF coming this year. If we look back at September 2019 in the US, as liquidity was starting to be withdrawn from the system, there was a pretty significant spike in the overnight SOFR rate. We went from 2.43% to 5.25% in 24 hours. In fact, actually, in the intraday, it got up to as high as 10%, which sort of prompted people to think about the withdrawal of liquidity and what that might mean for the system and some potential risks that could occur as we withdraw liquidity. Are you concerned, or perhaps could you talk us through your thought process on the roll-off of the TFF and whether that might potentially lead to some market dysfunction?
I'm not concerned. I am alert, but I expect the process to run pretty smoothly. Remember, of course, we've already started this, so about $10 billion already run off in recent times. There's another not quite $70 billion to run off between now and the 30th of September, and then next year another, the rest of it, $110 billion by June 30 next year. And, of course, that has implications, as Joe suggested, for banks' funding costs, bond markets, money markets. So we'll watch this carefully, but banks have been planning pretty well in advance. Again, APRA's been ensuring that they have. They've been issuing bonds in advance to repay the TFF. I think it's helpful, though, to recognise there's two types of needs. There's some banks that need money in their ES accounts to pay us back. There are other banks that have a lot of money already in their ES accounts. They don't need that to pay us back. But remember, they got that money from the TFF by pledging collateral, and a lot of the time that was securitised mortgages. So that gave them a lot of extra liquidity. So as that process unwinds, they need to go get that liquidity because they'll be losing the ES balances and they need to replace that with other HQLA, government bonds, semis. So that process has started. In fact, it started prior to the TFF with the CLF running down. Banks are issuing bonds. They can issue more term deposits. That helps the adjustment as well, and there's been some of that happening. But those balance sheet adjustments, they're already in train, they're running smoothly, and as best we can tell, that's likely to be the case.
Yeah, I guess as long as global capital markets continue to fill the void, then
sure,
there should be no disruption
right
to that market.
And the March episode was sort of, something we're all watching very carefully, and banks pulled back, as you would think, but it was for a short, brief period of time, and then Australian banks were out there issuing again in good quantity at good prices.
Yeah, absolutely, very quickly, which shows obviously high global demand for our bank's paper, which is a strong sign and feeds through to the stability of the local financial system. Stuart, we might jump across now to what's being asked of you from your clients, if we can. In particular, as we talked about in the introduction, your focus on derivatives. What's being asked of you, is it a tactical use of derivatives across your investment portfolio, or is it more structural applications to synthetically create that exposure? And then that allows you to create more cash in reserves?
Yeah, I think Australian investors are getting a lot more sophisticated in their use of derivatives. And if you take a look again at the super fund industry, there's really only one essential use for derivatives, and that's currency hedging. So every institutional super fund would have offshore assets, and they need a hedging program to be able to manage their foreign exchange risks. Every other use of derivatives is really optional. But we're finding that there's this increasing recognition of how they can be utilised both for defensive and offensive reasons, if you like. One is to protect returns and the other is to generate returns. And I guess a defensive use of derivatives is using options for tail protection. An offensive way might be using futures for a tactical asset allocation program to tilt away from their strategic asset allocation. With the increasing sensitivity to your future, your super benchmarks, we're seeing super funds using derivatives to just narrow that tracking error to the benchmarks from their underlying asset mix. And as you mentioned, there's that substitution effect as well, where a super fund might want to replace physical investments synthetically with derivatives, either for increasing flexibility or to generate an additional return.
Yeah, and then actually, if we talk about the sort of the advent and the growing nature of derivative usage, particularly in the super fund sector, it'd be topical to then talk about the UK pension crisis from September 2022. Once again, put derivatives firmly in the spotlight, and I think also through COVID, we saw with the main eight Canadian pension funds as well who ran into actually probably almost a positive case on how they managed their liquidity risk given the size of sort of the derivative hedging portfolios they had, particularly using foreign exchange. What lessons could Australian investors learn through that, and what are you taking away from those crises on how you build your portfolio?
Yep, I think probably the first thing to highlight is the main difference with the UK pension crisis and the liability-driven investment funds, which is where the epicenter was of that event. They often use leverage. So there's leverage embedded into their investment programs, which is something the super funds can't do. So that's the main key difference. And we know that the UK government budget triggered a sell-off for the gilt market, but it was really the behaviour of the funds and their the initial sell-off on gilts weakened their stance. They had to put up margin calls, which further exacerbated the sell-off in gilts, and you had this vicious circle which the Bank of England ended up having to come in and really intervene in the market to put a stop to it. If I was to put the three main causes down of that mini crisis, one would be the leverage that's embedded in that system. Two would be really poor collateral management. They had to raise cash all the time rather than being able to put the gilts up as collateral themselves. Thirdly, just a failure of the imagination when it comes to your stress testing. The fact that event was, unforeseen, that there would be that much of a sharp sell-off in the gilt market. I think if there's key learnings for domestically, one would be, in terms of stress testing, use that imagination, and particularly given the speed of events, have a look at how you're defining what's liquid and what's not liquid. So in a fund's liquidity management plan, they may consider that anything that could be sold up to 30 days without adversely impacting the market is liquid. You see with the speed of these events, 30 days is way too long. Even 5 days is too long. You need cash instantly. If you've got member switching or you've got margin calls to make, you really need access to cash in a hurry. I think that's the key learnings there for the domestic industry.
Yeah, it's a great point on the speed, on the which, we all talk about sort of the advent of apps and real-time payments, but that has increased an additional risk on which needs to be managed on the speed at which these things can occur. So perhaps, Jay, that's an opportune time to come back and ask you a question on. Earlier this year, we had the failure of both Silicon Valley Bank and obviously then the follow-up on First Republic, which does highlight those liquidity risks and how you would manage those risks within the balance sheet. Also, how quickly a run can occur with real-time transfers and perhaps the advent of social media as well. How have those events this year, and then also some discussions around IRRBB locally and APS 117 coming in, change the way that you look at the liquidity and market risk for the bank?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things coming out of Silicon Valley Bank in particular. I think what it has done is really reiterated the fact that strong balance sheet management is critical for any organisation. I think that when you look at some of the activities that were undertaken in Silicon Valley Bank, it wasn't just one thing, it was a multiple range of things where the practices were probably not those that you'd associate with strong balance sheet management. So I think that that's a really important thing, and I'll come back to. The other thing I think that was really clear coming out of Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic Bank, and Chris touched on this a bit earlier, is just that when regulation is done well, it can really strengthen an overall system. And I think that that's, from an institution perspective, that is really clear. And I think that that has been one of the sort of outcomes that I think has been observed through what we saw back in March. Yeah, I guess from my perspective, looking at some of these things, I think having the fact that we've got strong liquidity in the Australian banks, I think having the appropriate way of managing our liquid assets through and as I said before, thinking about these from a HQLA perspective, what is the what is the strongest form of liquidity that we can be holding here on our balance sheet? How do we account for those? So, what's our hold to maturity versus, we have no hold to maturity. We have everything through fair value and through OCI. Things like that make a real difference at those times when you've got volatility in markets. And I think that one of the things that I observed through SVB was while we did have a number of our particularly offshore investors come and ask questions, as I'm sure they asked many of their the issuers across their portfolios. The thing for us was it just wasn't a big deal. It didn't become a big issue for the Australian banks. And I think it really does go back to the fact that the practices and that we deploy across our sheet, the way we manage our interest rate risk, and the fact that Australia is the only jurisdiction that has IRRBB in Pillar 1. Many things that, when you actually were talking to investors over that time and responding to their questions, they really got a sense of the strength of not just the bank, but also the broader system. And I think that was a key learning for us. I think from a deposit side, obviously, concentration of deposits is pretty critical. And I think that when you look at, where there were concentrations, particularly with SVB, that was a real weakness. So again, it's thinking about those concentrations on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, perfect. So Chris, getting back to those challenges, I guess the real-time payments within the banking system that have created, what challenges does this pose for financial markets, and what is the RBA? How is the RBA looking at this?
I guess I'd say come back to the fact that right now there's actually a lot of liquidity in the system. Right? So many banks are sitting on very large ES balances, and that's the highest, most liquid asset you can have. Even so, we're still monitoring things very consistently on a regular basis. We look at financial market prices, bid offer spreads, market depth, these sorts of things. We're talking all the time to our counterparties, market contacts, and they know our number if they're feeling stress and can tell us. We look at demand coming through our weekly auctions, these sorts of things. So if we needed to, in quick time, we could provide extra liquidity. There's so much liquidity in the system at the moment, though, that we've been able to pull back our open market operations to a weekly thing, which is fine. But we've got flexibility. If we needed to, we could change that schedule and introduce more frequent open market operations. We saw demand at those auctions pick up a bit during these banking stresses in March. Even though Australian banks were far from the centre of any of that, there was still some effect. But it was pretty modest and it was pretty short-lived. We could offer, we've got other facilities as well to provide liquidity. Overnight repos is just one example. Anyway, so liquidity is more than adequate for the system as a whole, but that doesn't mean there can't be some demand pressures from time to time, and we'll be alert to that. And I think the other thing is, look, through all of that, monetary policy transmission is working as it should. So again, alert, but not concerned.
Perfect. Yeah, look, I think it goes back to, I guess, as you've said a couple of times over this panel session, is that there's, you know, the RBA, if required, has multiple levers that it can pull in a very quick manner. It has a very efficient transmission mechanism to the economy, and then coupled with the, you know, the extremely well-capitalised banking system, we're in a very strong position locally, which is great to see. Stuart, given the, I guess, the way the growth of the superannuation sector, actually, sort of two questions, if I can, for you is, one, we're seeing huge amounts of inflows of money moving into the superannuation sector, and I know there's been some discussion about concentration risk potentially moving into the ASX, where superannuation funds are owning sort of circa 32% of the market, growing quickly. So does that sort of potentially create any risk down the track? And then secondly, how are you looking at the assets that you have within your portfolio that could be unlocked, and the liquidity that they may provide through repo facility collateral switches, which are becoming more prevalent in the market?
Yeah, I think super funds naturally for a while are aware of the size of their investment pool versus the size of Australia's capital markets. So there's been this tendency to allocate more money offshore for quite a long time now, and that's something that trend is going to keep on going. You know, there's one is for concentration risk, but the other one is for diversification, of course. In terms of unlocking the value of their portfolios, that I'd say there's two things to talk about there, and one is there's this increasing appreciation for the value of the assets that funds have on their balance sheet. Whether it's the cash that they've got, or whether it's the securities, fixed income or equity securities. So I think there's going to be an increasing use of repo and securities lending, because given the heightened regulatory environment in banks, there's often a need for banks to have cash. That's not so much, we're talking about it now, not so much at the moment, but there's also often a need for banks to have certain securities. So there's a premium to be offered to be involved in the repo and securities lending markets. Another sophisticated, I guess, use of derivatives in this sense is what I call exposure management, which is where a fund which would traditionally allocate, let's say they want to top up their international equities exposure and allocate 3% to global equities, instead of just allocating that to a manager or investing themselves into physical equities, they might consider which expression is best and look at whether it's a physical expression, whether they can synthetically use derivatives through total return swaps or futures, because sometimes there's a funding advantage to be done through derivatives, and particularly in some markets, that's structural, and you can earn perhaps up to 5% additional return just through structuring it through the derivatives markets.
Yeah, it's a great point. I think it's where the power, I guess, of Australia's superannuation sector, the huge deep liquidity value that we have through whether it's outperformance notes, leveraging, or not, I shouldn't use the word leverage, but, you know, utilising the liquidity value that sits within those assets provides value to others, whether through repo lending facilities, our performance notes and things like that, which ultimately will benefit superannuation holders in the country. Finally, Chris, I'll ask you a question. Given your lens, along with the Governor, you're the representative on the BIS Committee on the Global Financial System for Markets Committee. What global perspectives can you bring from that forum to this group here today, and how does it help you with your stewardship of Australian monetary policy?
Yeah, I guess one of the... I mean, the value of those committees is great because you can get timely exchange of information. ideas, gain a better understanding also of our own systems by sort of doing a compare and contrast with others. The one thing that's really struck me in the past year or so is just how strikingly familiar many of the circumstances are. If you focus on, say, the Australian press, you'd think we were unique. And, you know, the high inflation that central banks are trying to fight, the very rapid tightening of monetary policy, that's a global phenomenon, at least across advanced economies. Not absolutely everyone. BOJ is an exception. So there's a lot of helpful exchange of information and lessons to be learned. And sometimes you can learn about the very different experiences, though, like the banking problems in the US and in Switzerland, what the authorities were doing. So that's very useful to get a timely read on how their markets are responding and what they're doing to help calm things down. Another issue we've been discussing is we all face this sort of less pressing but still important challenge of thinking about, as our balance sheets gradually decline over the coming years, what does that mean for our market operations? And again, it's helpful to get their perspective, see what they're thinking about, where are they heading, just so we can, that can inform our own planning. We're still a long way away from that and needing to change our operations, but it's helpful to be in that forum and get these insights from others.
Perfect, thank you. We have a couple of minutes left. We haven't got any questions on the app, but I'd just like to open up to, would anyone in the room like to ask a question? We've got microphones we can circulate.
Thanks so much for your comments, guys. I just wanted to ask, dovetail off of the commentary you made about the capital markets, particularly yourself, Joe and Nick. Given you have the TFF funding to repay, forgive me if I'm using the incorrect wording here, but I just would like to get a sense of where you might look for that capital. There's been reports about USD-covered bonds, overseas markets, local currencies. Can you talk a bit about where banks like Westpac and your peers can find this capital given the current market conditions?
Yeah, sure. So if you think about our term funding facility, we've got $30 billion of term funding, which is due for maturity over the next year and a half, I guess, out to September, out to June next year. You know, from our perspective, we've thought about that, and when we drew it down, we actually thought about how we would need to repay that when it came due. So we thought about when we drew it down in sort of smaller instalments over time as opposed to in big lumps. So for us, it's very much more about, you know, and the way we think about that is much more about the same way as we would any other wholesale funding maturity. So as we're sort of planning and thinking about our funding, we're looking at the various markets which are available to us. So the same markets we've been going to now for the last, you know, a decade or longer in terms of accessing those. So, you know, you've seen over the course of the last couple of months, we've been active in covered markets, we've been active in senior markets. You know, we did a Tier 2 transaction yesterday. That, you know, for us, it's about the range of issuance opportunities that we have across the globe. We have seen a very supportive domestic market, but also, importantly, we've seen supportive offshore markets as well. So the same sorts of investor markets that we would have gone to pre-COVID are where we're also looking to go back to. And we're, what I'd say is that we're receiving a very positive a response when we go back to those markets.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I can add to that from a HSBC perspective. I think, and domestically, is the same thing. We probably haven't been certainly not as frequent an issuer as Westpac, but I think coming out of COVID and the withdrawal and reduction of those liquidity facilities going in the past, we now need to think about how do we manage our capital in the right way. And as Joe said, it's as having as many options as possible. It's becoming a frequent issuer. To make sure investors are very comfortable with you and as an issuer going forward, and then becoming a frequent issuer as well. So that you have that developed curve that people can access and they know where your paper is trading, and there's it creates a pretty deep and active secondary market liquidity. So actually, I might follow up that answer with a question actually for you, Stuart, is, you know, do you see actually from an investment perspective that, you know, probably like to see more issuance in Aussie dollar paper for the superannuation funds and for the domestic investors, given, I guess, the local capital markets are still relatively, certainly smaller in size, but we're going to have a very deep, broad liquidity pool coming through from the superannuation sector?
I'd probably have a different answer to the rest of my other half of the team that I work with, who are the physical fixed income investors. They probably want to see more domestic paper.
Yeah.
I want to see more offshore because it creates that cross-currency basis to generate an additional return in currency hedging. So we'd probably have two different opposing views on that. For me, I'm ambivalent.
Spoken like a true derivative specialist. Yeah, fantastic. Perfect. Any other final questions for the panel? No. Okay.
Look.
There's one.
Oh, we've got one.
Back there.
I'm so sorry.
Valley Bank. Thank you. So all the trauma was going on with Silicon Valley Bank. You know, US Treasuries moved through 80-point range in 2 days. I'm just sort of interested in, obviously, the associated markets were very volatile. I'm just interested in what happened in your war rooms during that time, how you dealt, what was going on in your organisations in those 2 days.
Well, I can talk about Westpac. So in terms of, what we were looking at, pretty much the same stuff we look at all the time. So we are, looking at our liquidity, we're looking at our funding, we're looking at all of our risk positions, daily. And we're looking at how those risk positions are moving, what the impact of various market shifts would be. Obviously, we're very, there's probably a bit more interest in terms of, that from senior management and the like. So there's a bit more communication up the, up over that course of that period of time, and understanding whether there were any other knock-on consequences of that to other things that we might not have considered. So from our perspective, it was very much about using the tools that we have, using the information that we have that we look at very regularly, but also thinking about what is the new information that we have from various markets, and is there anything that we need to be thinking about differently to what we had been before, given the circumstances that were out there in the market. And the good thing was that when we looked at Silicon Valley Bank and we looked at some of the practices as I mentioned before, we're very pleased with the, and it probably reiterated to us that the way that we were performing some of our processes, the way we were thinking about our risk management, the way that we were managing our liquidity, the way that we were dealing in with the regulator and the like, was actually, there wasn't a lot that we had to change because of that. So, from our perspective, it was it reinforced a lot of things that we knew, but probably gave us some greater, comfort in terms of some of the practices that we undertake regularly anyway.
Yeah, I'd reiterate the same thing. I think the knee-jerk reaction was obviously a huge amount of questions being asked sort of at a board level. But I think, as Joe said, actually we got through it really quickly, and it reiterated that Australia's banking system is really sound. I think with as Chris has mentioned many times, there is a deep pool of liquidity locally, and from the way we manage our risk through LCR and NSFR basis, there was no real concerns, I think, that we held locally. So we were able to move on pretty quickly from that. And again, that just highlighted the strength of the system and how we've managed the risks as a banking sector domestically, and probably why Australia is sort of best in class as well. I think that's probably it.
Yeah, I guess the regulator did obviously ask for more frequent reporting, and I think all of the banks provided that. So there was the normal responses that you'd expect to see from the regulatory fraternity, the interaction, communication that you'd expect to see. It kind of happened as you would expect. But you've got to remember, we do a lot of our own, you know, fire drills and stress testing and planning for these types of events. And the good thing is that when an event occurred, that we sort of were able to go through the steps that we have in place, and it played out as in a positive way.
Perfect. I think it's probably a good time to end, highlighting the strength of the local financial system and how the three panellists manage their risk on an extremely effective manner. So first of all, I'd just like to thank Joe, Chris and Stuart for their time today, and thanks to all the audience. Much appreciated.